It's a great privilege and pleasure for me to present this year's medal to Justin Champion. As a historian of early modern history and ideas, Justin's work has always been informed by a concern to capture the experience and ideas of the inarticulate many rather than the articulate few, or more accurately, the many who the sources have rendered inarticulate. Justin has found the sources to enable the inarticulate many to speak. For example, his work on the social geography of the Great Plague. Above all, he has found the voices of anti-establishment figures. He has been particularly interested in 17th and 18th century criticisms of established religion. This informed his book that came out of his PhD, the Cambridge book on the pillars of priestcraft shaken on the Church of England and its critics in the late 17th and early 18th century. And I'm delighted that his PhD supervisor, Mark Goldie, is here tonight as well. And then, of course, his book on John Toland, Republican Learning, and indeed some of his current research on Thomas Hobbes and the criticisms of public religion. This work on people who have been, in Hobsbawm's phrase, E.P. Thompson's phrase, victims of the massive condescension of posterity, has informed Justin's passion for public history. He has striven to widen the range of people who are studied by historians, with the result and the hope that we can interest a wider, more diverse audience who would find these subjects exciting and relevant. This commitment to public history has been demonstrated in Justin's countless TV and radio appearances, a particular stalwart, I'm delighted to say, of Radio 4, and his relationship with Melvyn Bragg and the success of that. His key role in the master's program at Royal Holloway in public history, which is a degree that works in close partnership with external heritage and media institutions. His role in the commemoration of Magna Carta and the Glorious Revolution. His work on public history for both the Royal Historical Society and the Historical Association. He has been particularly committed to the vital role, and no point in our history has, I think, this been more important, his vital role in sustaining the function of history as a key element of citizenship in a modern, informed democracy. When Lawrence earlier talked about he would like to see a little less cozy anger and more, a little less cozy a relationship and a more righteous anger, then he must have been thinking of Justin when he would say, this is the exemplar of what a little less cozy nostalgia and more righteous anger should mean. In Justin's presidency of the Historical Association, this was consistently informed by his passionate commitment to extending the outreach of the association, particularly to school children and particularly in debates about modern citizenship. Everywhere I go to talk to branches, people very kindly and politely say, thank you very much for coming, it's a very nice talk, and the rest of it. And they say, but my predecessor's visits have been memorable and inspirational. So I know where I stand. The award of the Medlicott Medal this year is a salute to Justin's scholarship, but above all, to his passion, to his enthusiasm, and to his courage. It's a great pleasure and privilege on my part to award the Medlicott Medal for 2018 to Justin Champion.
You've done better than I did.
Thank you very much.
Now Justin will say a few righteously angered words.
Thank you. Am I turned on? Good. How can you tell from here? Oh. Tony, you nearly made me cry again. I'm getting very tired of these sorts of things. Because very often I sit there and think, they've got the wrong person again. It's classic imposter syndrome. You know, really, they mean somebody else. But I'm going to give you a talk today that hopefully will inspire some reflection, but may very well make everybody in the room very, very, very angry. And if it does, good. And I want that there's a disclaimer. What I am not going to say is that when you leave this room, you will go out and set fire to statues or objects that you don't approve of. I am suggesting that we need to think much harder about what those statues mean to different sorts of communities. So I've given you a nice title, Defacing the Past or Resisting Oppression. And one of the reasons why I'm interested in this is partially that I'm about to start a new research project on material artifacts and the representation of freedom and liberty in the 18th century. So I've had to start thinking about themes and how to make them talk, how to make statues talk or objects talk. And one of the reasons why I've become very interested is partially actually through conversations with Hakim about the woeful absence of respect for minority cultures in this country. And the other person who unfortunately can't be here this evening because she has a very bad toothache is the London novelist Dreda St. Mitchell, who I engaged with on Radio 4 about Roads Must Fall. And really, in thinking about that, it made me understand, while I was perfectly sympathetic both about Roads Must Fall in Cape Town, and remember, in Cape Town, the object is archived in a public space. But of course, the Daily Mail, the Daily Telegraph, and great thinkers like Simon Jenkins regard this sort of attack on inanimate objects as somehow cultural desecration, vandalism, Stalinism. All of these accusations have been made. But when we think about, and I advise you to try it, wander about central London, there are all sorts of statues of people who nobody has the foggiest idea who they are. And once you start thinking about who they are, you'll either be deeply, deeply bored or very, very, very cross that something has been erected in a material form. So when we walk about, statues aren't just objects. They inform and shape the world we live in. And for some communities, those statues are abhorrent. So this was Roads Must Fall at Oriel College. And if I had another 2 or 3 hours, I could talk you through some of the responses to this uprising, if you like, of passion about the problem. And if you want to get a little glimpse, just go on the comments pages in The Guardian. And if you want to see quite how appalling many of the people who even read The Guardian are about the issue of race and oppression, you will find it there. And some of the comments make you want to weep. This is a recent example of the new Lord Mayor of Bristol, Cleo Lake, who's had enough. There's been a lot of debate about the legacy of the slave trade and the issues of reparations in Bristol. Well, she wasn't going to be Lord Mayor and sit and work underneath a painting of Coulson and has had it removed because she says it made her feel ill. Now, of course, why not? She's Lord Mayor. That's her prerogative. But of course, this is regarded as disappearing historical evidence. And one of the things you as historians, I'm sure, will already have twigged, historians are used to preserving archives, not encouraging others to go and tamper with them. But of course, I'm not suggesting that we destroy objects. I'm suggesting that we play with them. We do things with them. We contextualize them. And now in a digital age, this is enormously easy if it's taken seriously. So I'm just going to give you a little run through. One of the arguments I want to sort of get you to think about is that if we look at how statues have been treated in the past, adjusting statues, whether it's by tipping red paint all over them or writing on them, and in one sense, as the great French theorist not Michel Desserteaux, but Guy Debord, talked about détournement, turning things upside down, compromising them, appropriating them, making them act in the way, other way than they meant to be. One of the consequences of Rhodes Must Fall saw some of our very committed students, women of color at Royal Holloway, make comments about the fact that in the middle of their university quad was a statue that had Queen Victoria, Empress of India, and that made them feel uncomfortable. Now, there's no doubt, and Humayun and various other people in the room will have had conversations with the particular student, there's no doubt she was a reflective, serious student who was not suggesting Queen Victoria must fall. But go back and look at the dates. You only need to put in Queen Victoria, Royal Holloway, and Daily Mail, and you will find bile of a sort that it's embarrassing to be English. I know we're probably going to beat the Belgians tonight, but but it really, I mean, and the Belgians have their own terrible colonial past, but the student union and the student concerned published a response pointing out that some of the national newspapers had published lies, and both the Independent and the Times had to withdraw their statements. They'd made it up. Now, why is it that certain views about what we do with statues are vilified and others are enormously well celebrated? I've got a little sort of bit, I won't spend a lot of time talking about Queen Victoria, but she's come in for a lot of grief around the globe, whether it's in the Punjab, in Montreal, in Quebec. They've delighted over the last century in smashing, decapitating, and staining Queen Victoria. She was blown up. But the good old Canadians rehabilitating Queen Victoria and indeed sticking her head back on with a view to putting it back up. One might speculate about why bother, because it'll only get destroyed later on. This is in Guyana. This happened recently. This was 1954 when Victoria was decapitated. More recently, she's been drenched in red paint to symbolize the violence that the Victorian Empire, you know, Mike Davis, the great American historian, has actually talked about the late Victorian Holocaust caused by the British state around Asia and elsewhere. Now, this sort of tradition, that's an even better, poor chap has to try and clean it up. And one might imagine if you wanted a job creation scheme, encouraging more people to, you know, adjust the statues would provide lots more employment, especially after Brexit, for people who can clean statues. So I'm leaving you there with another picture of Queen Victoria, and I want just to reflect a little bit on the long history of toppling or damaging statues. In antiquity, and I'm very conscious that there are some people in the audience who know an awful lot more about this than me, there was a thing called damning the memory. Got it at the bottom, you probably can't see it. Damnatio memoriae, or obliterating the memory. It was a classically acceptable activity for those bad people, or those who brought dishonor on a community, to have their statues pulled down. And some of the articles I've read in the last couple of weeks, even worse than statues, their bodies might be disinterred, and in some cases even eaten. And this was a sense in which these people have damaged the community morality and therefore need to be erased. Now, of course, there are also attempts to erase them from the sort of written records of the time. And I can see Alison Brown in the corner saying, this was a tradition that was rediscovered in the Renaissance amongst Italian republics who used the same sort of notion of damnatio memoriae to as an instrument of political authority and power. So if it was good enough for the Florentines and the Romans, why isn't it good enough for us today? Poor old Queen Victoria. This is yet another one, Port Elizabeth. And of course, this was only a few years ago and is a statement about the current politics that were existing in that country then. Even better, she's... Statue of Queen Victoria in China, in Hong Kong. So Queen Victoria is without a doubt an emblem of imperial oppression, whether you live in India, Canada, England, or China. Hong Kong were even better. They decided, let's not destroy it, we'll just put big boards up. Now, one of the problems that, of course, the classicists are very aware of is that when you try and erase something, and we could get very trendy with Jacques Derrida, when you try and erase something, you, of course, leave evidence of its existence. So you draw attention to that complexity. Putting up big boards is not the best way to hide something, especially when the banner says, celebrating the 20th anniversary of Hong Kong's return to the motherland. So again, trying to rewrite history. It's another example of another part of China being attacked. Now, can I ask anybody, who is this? Anybody know? This is what Ken Livingstone would call an obscure statue. I've walked past it, and probably anybody who's ever been to the Institute of Historical Research will have walked past it hundreds of times. Now, I only noticed it 3 weeks ago when, obviously, some very brave women had climbed to the top and put suffragette colours on it. Now, this is Francis, Duke of Bedford, 5th Duke. Who cares? What did he do? He did nothing. He was a little bit like Thomas Holloway in the fact that he innovated a new form of hair powder. Now, I don't think dressing him in suffragette colours was somehow a deep-seated response to the threat of hair powder to women's cosmetics. But looking at this statue, it suddenly struck me, you can make a statement without actually knowing what the hell or who the hell this statue is. Just by the fact of the, if you like, the grandeur of the Earl of Bedford being sort of upturned by being dressed in suffragette clothes, means you don't have to paint it, you don't have to smash it up, you just have to dress it in an appropriate way. So Francis, Duke of Bedford. And if you're more interested, I'm sure everybody's capable of looking at Wikipedia. It's a very, very beautiful statue. And of course, I'm pretty sure he paid for it himself. So a little bit like Jeremy Bentham, we can all become our own icons if we've got enough money. Now, statues, of course, can be enormously contemporary. And one of the things I was, if I'd had a two-hour session, was going to talk about is how do you get a statue put up? And if you go to Google and put in regulations for the erection of statues, you'll see there's a huge amount. In Westminster, it's a 50-page document. And, of course, the major problem is you need some money. And then you need connections. So there is a growing tradition of, if you like, improvised statues. This is, as I'm sure you'll know, Edward Snowden, that was put up and then very, very quickly pulled down in Brooklyn Park, 2015. Not an item of news that I saw covered in the BBC or in the newspapers at all. These are three of them. This is a piece of art that's been displayed in Berlin, in Geneva, and elsewhere. Snowden, Assange, and Chelsea Manning. Again, this is a mobile project. There's a little bit like Hugh Locke's statues, seats for Magna Carta. It has a fourth seat for visitors to stand on so that they can become part of that tradition. So these are statues that are connecting very much, and we'll see how long they stay there. David Dormino. I love the name, Anything to Say. Now, there's another great way of thinking about statues is just to dismiss it as vandalism. It's not trying to bring integrity to communal memory. It's just rampant vandalism. And Winston Churchill, although I should be very careful what I say as a graduate of Churchill College, Winston Churchill has attracted a lot of attention. Now, of course, some of this is very much regarded as vandalism. And I'm sure you can remember the orgia that was poured on David Gilmour's son. He was drunk. He was being stupid. But he attacked the cenotaph. And this was regarded not as the act of an idiot, or as a serious act of political protest. They wanted to throw him in prison for decades. Every time you put a statue to Winston Churchill up, and I'm sure there's at least one person in the room who may have done naughty things to a bust of Churchill in Churchill College, but I shan't mention them. These are in recent years, and in every circumstance, Churchill's statue attracts contemporary political statements. And, you know, it's up for everybody to decide for themselves. Is this just inappropriate, unacceptable? Or is it telling us something? As historical evidence, is it telling us something about how these symbols, this iconography, drives hostility or is seen as an act of oppression? Everybody knows this one. Where is this? Glasgow. You know that because you told me about it. That's my daughter, by the way. This statue in Glasgow, there's a sort of bond with the local community. Wellington, I believe, and his horse must never be without their cones. So if they are removed by wind or police officers, they are put back straight away. And it's almost become an icon of Glasgow. What it means is, Lord knows what, that'll be for others to think about later. Now, one of the things I want to try and convince you of is when nasty people abroad have their statues destroyed, the press is overjoyed. Look, we brought freedom to the Russians, to the Iraqis, and they've pulled their statues down. Aren't we good? So these are quite dramatic photographs. You know, everywhere across the world, statues of Lenin were being pulled down. Now, we know who Lenin is, probably because we've seen so many statues of him being pulled down. But this individual, does anybody know who this is? Ken Livingstone, Mayor of London, got in terrible trouble from guess who? The Daily Mail. Ken said, this is a totally innocuous, pointless statue. Nobody knows who he is. Well, there you are, Charles James Napier, General. Not a very nice man, Trafalgar Square. Ken was suggesting that statues like this were irrelevant. They didn't aid any sort of cultural or collective memory, so something should be done about them. He didn't say pull them down. His immediate reception was that he wanted to pull down Nelson's Column. Now, here's two forms of damnation of memory. This is the famous statue of Saddam. There's two forms of damnation, from above and below. The one on the right is an American soldier bringing freedom and the flag to Iraq. The one on the left is a local Iraqi in Baghdad taking his hammer to show his dislike of the previous regime. So a political act. The first on the right is presumably an act of imperial action. Everybody is very pleased when Stalin statues are pulled down. They're not quite so pleased that some of them are going back up again. Now, has anybody got a quibble with this? You know, obviously Hitler was a very bad man, so every shred of iconographical support for him should be removed, but archived. I'm sure there are historians working on accounts of Hitler. I love this one. Anybody know who the statue is? 1492 is a clue. Columbus. Columbus is being taken down to be replaced by an indigenous people's statue. Over there we have the Egyptian Mubarak being smashed. And again, we have Saddam's head. So in Venezuela, they've decided they don't want any more remnants of Columbus. They only brought, if you like, trauma to their continent. Now, I quite like that replacement. You know, this isn't just idle destruction. This is creative capturing of spaces. Now, I tread carefully here, because Helen will know much more about this. That's a rather controversial remnant of Franco's regime, as is that. So the Arc of Victory and Franco's tomb. There we have the last statue of Franco being removed. And of course, the consequence of the Spanish Civil War and its atrocities is the creation, and I won't talk about it now because I really don't know enough about it, and Helen does, so I might ask her to speak, is a statement on historical memory. And that statement on how to handle and how to encounter the remnants of an oppressive past, whether it's statues, documents, military insignia, is also replicated in the Punjab, where, as a post-colonial country, there were issues with what do you do with road names. They're all named after generals or pointless bits of Surrey. as many bits of Surrey are named after bits of India, but it's quite bizarre. It's probably a trade to be done in street names, you know, taking them off. Because here we have again, poor old Lenin. I've even got a map for you. You know, evidence of the systematic. Now, how is it that in Western Europe we can regard this as a positive outcome, whereas if we start taking down imperial statues of colonial oppressors, we're doing the wrong thing. We're erasing history. We're destroying the record. Some people like Lenin. So in Havana, he's guarded by proper soldiers and fake figurines. If we turn to America, and I'll speed up a bit, and because again, Tony will know much, much more about this, but you'll know about Charlottesville, and you'll know about the trauma and horror of how the debates around what these statues of Confederate military figures mean to local communities. Black Lives Matter. The sense in which the Confederate Trumpians claim this is part of their cultural heritage has been exposed, because most of these statues were put up well after the Confederate Wars and were mass-produced. They were acts in the 1930s and 40s of restating a sort of essentially racist claim. So this is what happens in the US. You have to call the police out to defend statues. That'll be a bit difficult when Theresa May has cut back the police force so much. There's so many statues of Victoria, you'd have to have thousands of new officers. Again, this is in Charleston. And you know, is this a legitimate act of appropriation, or is this an act of vandalism? I think, again, it's for you to decide. But this is everywhere. And one of the things we can see, a little bit like the Lord Mayor of Bristol, in Baltimore and in New Orleans, through the democratic process, the local government, the local council, is demanding that these figures be taken down. So it's not, if you like, an act of dissidence and vandalism. It's an act of state. I love this one. This is real damnatio memoriae, I think. Adjusting here, criticizing this terrible figure of Louis Botha. Now, this is a small example, again, in Baltimore, where statues were removed and attempts to replace them with icons like Harriet Tubman, or in this case, a sort of improvised statue, were put up. Again, it didn't stay up very long. It was toppled almost straight away. This is another way we might memorialize the trauma of racist or imperial oppression is by having a museum. Perhaps cart all these images off to a museum and frame them with historical knowledge. This is the National Memorial to Peace and Justice in the States. I haven't visited. It looks a very beautiful place, but it's appalling. These are bottles of dirt taken from sites where lynchings happened. across the US. You know, visiting that must be appalling. And these are columns of those who died and evidence, historical stories of those who were kidnapped. Now, I want very briefly, because I haven't got my watch, I have no idea when I started, just to turn, you know, is it just these terrible colonials, you know, Americans, Indians, and even a few East Europeans that do this appalling sort of thing? What about in England? Do we have any tradition of damaging statues? Well, everybody knows who this is, because again, you may have even walked past him today. Charles I, equestrian statue at Trafalgar Square. Made in 1633, and then very carefully removed by the new model army's edicts, and buried, destroyed it was meant to be, but wonderfully, a good royalist with an eye to make a few quid said he'd melted it down and made forks for royalists to buy. And then, of course, when the king was restored, he miraculously found it and sold it back, where it's been ever since. Now, it's quite an unrealistic equestrian statue. Hubert Le Sueur did it, because Charles wasn't that tall. His legs certainly weren't that long. But every time there's a protest around Trafalgar Square, a little bit like Wellington in Glasgow, the Socialist Workers' Party or other groups managed to daub him. I couldn't find... They normally put a high-visibility jacket on him. So transforming yet another traditional monarchical symbol into somehow a site for protest. George I, well, there's a dull man. And, you know, if we want another location within the British Isles, and I use that very loosely, go to Dublin. They thought this was the best thing to do after George I's accession was put up a nice statue to the Hanoverian Protestant. And quite properly, when the 20th century came after the Republic was formed, for the safety of George I, he was moved to Birmingham, where, again, he sits outside the Student Guild and is very frequently decked in high-vis jackets and all the appropriate stuff that a king on horseback ought to wear. Now, this is yet another example of how even in the 17th century they were very good at reappropriating statues. This is a statue of Charles II that was originally commissioned for erection in Poland that showed the King John Sobieski, King of Poland, trampling on a Turk. It was made shortly after 1683 when he had resisted the Turkish invasion. At the Restoration, a very wealthy city type decided to buy the statue and try, although you'll see it didn't do it very well. This is the Turk, and this is, well, he remodeled him as Cromwell. Charles II tramples on Cromwell. Bit of a shame, that. But who cares? That's just doing things with statues. Now, of course, I think there's at least one American in the room, if not more. The Americans did it first and best because their statue toppling caused a revolution. And look how well that went. Number 45 is really, you know, a traditional view. So this is Bowling Green in 1776, where George III's statue was pulled down to make bullets to fire against the British. But once again, the Americans have decided that they will reconstruct the glorious statue of George III. And I don't know whether Trump knows about this yet. Perhaps he'll chat with the Queen when he comes to visit her. And they're going to put the statue back up. So you can be saved from eternal damnation if you've got the right artist involved. Now, the worst person, of course, with all of this is Oliver Cromwell, Anne Widdecombe's favourite statue. You know, the Minister of Secretary of State has said very often she wants to vandalise this. So it must be okay for people to vandalise statues if the Home Secretary thinks it's a good thing. Of course, we know that statues of Oliver Cromwell were not put up by public subscription, they pretended. But normally it's local, in the case of St. Ives and Warrington, local dissenting groups who reinvented Cromwell in the 19th century as a defender of freedom and liberty. And there's a great myth. The statue of Cromwell outside the House of Commons looks across the road at a tiny little statue, a bust of Charles I. And it's been a great myth that, you know, this is, they've been staring at each other for all eternity. Absolute nonsense. The Cromwell statue was put up in 1899, and this statue at the back of St. Margaret's Church was put up in 1956 by the slightly eccentric Society for the Promotion of Charles the Martyr. So there's a politics that persists about the 17th century into the 20th, and that's the lovely little report in the Glasgow Herald. God knows why they reported it. But. So just a few more images of Cromwell. You know, Cromwell, perhaps our greatest leader. No debate. Bit of hostility. Maybe if we were Irish, we might have a different view. So perhaps the perception of what a statue means depends on what sort of community identity you have. So telling people they can't be offended by a statue is not really acceptable if they are. But I do note that Cromwell gets on the Statue of Great Men in Geneva. I rather like that idea. And there's no statues to Charles I or Charles II or Queen Victoria in Geneva. Can't think why. But these are lovely. And yet, Cromwell has a bad, bad reputation. So childish MPs, and one would love to be able to point the finger at Boris Johnson, because he's a sort of public schoolboy who would do exactly this. This statue on the left here is in the House of Commons, in a public space, and constantly it's being turned to face the wall. Oh, how brave is that? You know, I turned a statue around, I'm making a real political statement here. And once you start looking for them, there are statues of Cromwell just about everywhere. But of course, they don't have visibility, because until the Age of Revolutions came in, we rather disappeared the 17th century because we did naughty things like chop kings' heads off and ask them to leave and established a Bill of Rights. I think some of these are rather beautiful. And he creeps up in all sorts of strange places. They're still making statues to Cromwell. And these are beautiful stained glass windows. Now, memorials aren't always celebrating the great. Memorials very often want to remember tragedy. And this is a statue for the Comfort Women put up in San Francisco, not in Japan. And of course, the mayor of Osaka regards this as a great affront to the integrity and dignity of his country. I love this one. This has only been put up very recently in Denmark, commemorating when the Danish government sold its Caribbean colonies to the Americans, I think. John will know that. You've been to one of these, haven't you? Yeah, to America. So the Danish government has put up a fantastic statue of a woman who led the resistance, Queen Mary, also known as Fireburn. And interestingly, the person who commissioned the statue used the model of Huey Newton, leader of the Black Panther Party, as the symbolism to represent that. So it is possible to record serious statues and for states to invest in marginal figures. The statues are weird. I wanted to have a whole discourse, but I didn't have time to read it, about the flaneur. You know, wander around bits of London or any urban space and note how many statues there are and how many you know about them. Well, this is only round the corner on Victoria Embankment. We've got a very glorious camel representing some of the military forces in Egypt. And then we have a statue of Robert Burns next to him. What? How does that work? You've got to be a real serious postmodernist to make a connection between those two. And, you know, it's quite bizarre that these sorts of statues, we're inundated with them. There was a statue mania in the late 19th century, and we've somehow become over-familiar with them. We mainly ignore them, but as soon as you know who they are, they may become the sites that irritate and oppress. So we are finally getting there in the UK. We have a first statue to a black woman, Mary Seacole, and I'm sure everybody in the room remembers the fuss that was made. Oh, she wasn't Florence Nightingale. She was just a private member making money out of medicine. Why? Why was this a problem? So if you look at public history, public statues, and I had a reasonably good research assistant who forwarded me this. This is a BBC commission that shows predominantly the statues are of men, and mainly men who have names. Statues of women tend either to be symbolic or they don't have names at all. They're just women hanging out on the edge of a statue. Now, I want to go back to Nelson. You know, Ken got a good kicking for suggesting, although he didn't, that Nelson's column should be pulled down. Famously, a Venezuelan tourist wondered why there was a big statue in Trafalgar Square to a pirate. Because, of course, from the Venezuelan perspective, Nelson was a pirate. So this is Dublin. I wonder what happened to him. Oh dear. He was removed forcibly. Blast wrecks Nelson's pillar. His head is still preserved. But if we want to look more locally than India or China or elsewhere, go to Ireland. Look at the cleansing, if you like, of imperial symbols. And the replacement with liberators, Daniel Connell. Again, it would be fun to spend more time looking at the iconography around the base. And guess what? In order to have statues of Daniel O'Connell, you need to remove statues of Victoria, still. But this time, this was an act of state, and this is the way the anti-republicans responded. And this is poor old William III. One was removed and the others were destroyed. So where did Victoria go? They didn't break her up. They presented her to Sydney. They were going to give her to Canada, but the costs of transporting it were too much. So far from being brought up in Dublin, she's ended up in Sydney. And I haven't pursued this yet, but I wouldn't be surprised if in these times she's been redecorated. So I mentioned earlier, if you want to put a statue up, you can download this document, and good luck, because the bureaucracy around putting a new statue up makes even the REF look like a simple and straightforward activity. So there are attempts, and we know, you know, this is the anniversary century of suffragette activity. There are attempts to put up new statues to women. These haven't been made yet, but at least they're in embryo. And we have Millicent Fawcett and Emmeline and Christabel Pankhurst. So slowly, the women are taking over. The non-royal women are taking over. And there are fragments of new commemorations of black Britons. Walter Tull, the first British footballer, but also a receiver of the Military Cross, and Ledley King. I'm not quite sure why Ledley King is there, rather than, you know, Cole or any of the other much better footballers, but it's there. Yes, filth. Exactly, filth. Absolute filth. Should be somebody from Arsenal. Sorry, John. Now, I want to leave you just with a suggestion. I am not suggesting, although I wouldn't condemn, that we all go out and smash statues up or drape them. I think draping them is fine, but probably putting paint over them isn't environmentally very good. But Talking Statues has started a project that uses modern digital technology. I can't remember the acronym, but basically, if you walk past one of the statues, it will phone you up. And the statue will talk to you. Say, "Hi, I'm Nelson. I'm a very bad man." Now, this, you can, if you go to talkingstatues.co.uk, you can receive the report. And this is the map of the statues and this is a global project. It's happening in New York, it's happening in Chicago, it's happening everywhere. Strangely enough, in just this little tour of London, you get two statues of Victoria, please. And no marginal figures at all. These are the people they chose to do the, you know, they get important people like Jeremy Paxman to do a phone call. Isaac Newton, well, Robert will be happy with that. A goat, Peter Pan. I don't know who Hodge the Cat is. I haven't really dug into this yet. But pretty much, you know, this is a pretty mainstream collection of statues. And surprisingly enough, that the illustration on the left is of how the technology works, so I won't bother you with that. Let's just say it works. And it's not too expensive. This is an assessment of who found this useful. And you'll notice, and I wonder if this has anything to do with the statues that were chosen, that overwhelmingly it's white English British people, 62%. Any other white background. And if you look at the minorities here, white and black Caribbean, 0.5% engaged with and use this facility. And we know from the research these people did that if you got involved with this, you then pursued into the museums and into reading more historical inquiry. So it works. John Wilkes, I haven't seen this yet, but the thought of being told about John Wilkes, a great resister of late Stuart tyranny, by Jeremy Paxman, I'm afraid, doesn't really appeal very much. If it was Russell Brand, maybe it would be more enjoyable. Probably be ruder, but... In America, they've actually much more diverse. And, you know, one of the simple things that didn't happen in the first London project was all the podcasts were in English. In America, the podcasts are in Spanish, Greek, Italian, and English. So that they're at least communicating with a broader community because of the diversity. And this is Frederick Douglass, interestingly, standing outside the New York historical, the equivalent of the IHR, I guess. We haven't got any statues at the IHR yet. Yet, I'll make one. Now, I want to leave you, and I really will stop. What do we do with these statues? And I think, you know, partially through the opportunity I had with Magna Carta to see at close quarters the work of the Guyanan artist, Hugh Locke, who has created a fantastic public commemorative activity, piece of art on Runnymede Meadows. Hugh Locke, and all of this stuff is online. You can even buy some of the items. Hugh Locke likes to dress statues of oppressive people. Very often, these are statues of Edward Burke and of Edward Colston in Bristol, both heavily involved in the slave trade. And you know, these are works of art, but they're appropriating and subverting oppressive statues. And guess what? He's quite good at doing it to kings and queens. I was going to put up Sex Pistols, God Save the Queen, but I couldn't find one in copyright. And guess what? Even Queen Victoria has been created and adapted and contextualized. And I think these are really quite beautiful, trying to give an environmental dimension to some of the work. But I want to leave you with the jurors. And if you haven't visited yet, please go, because it's spellbinding. 12 seats made out of bronze, all decorated with, you know, Nelson Mandela, the key to Nelson Mandela's cell, the key to Oscar Wilde's cell, symbols from ancient China about freedom and liberty. And they are designed to be sat on. They're designed to be used. And if you ever get the chance to watch young people thinking about, well, what does this mean? Well, they're juries. They're jury seats. So they're showing how that tradition of defending liberty still persists. So what do we do with our statues? I leave it up to you. I'll keep an eye on the news. Thank you.